the smokestacks were hanging on by a thread. They didn't just need to be the first piece because it was so iconic. They needed to be restored so they wouldn't fall down as construction was going on.
Welcome to the fourth and final episode of the Building Reuse is Climate Action limited series sponsored by Quinn Evans. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and preservationist who specializes in sustainable design. Many of you know me as the host of the Tangible Remnants podcast, where I demystify the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Beyond the podcast, I'm also an associate principal at Quinn Evans, where I help to bring adaptive reuse projects to life. This limited series will highlight one successful adaptive reuse project per episode, and will feature people involved in the project from both the design side and the client side. This series is going to pull back the curtain and do a deep dive into each project to discuss how a project went from conception to completion, the lessons learned along the way, and how the building is positively impacting the community today. By the end of each episode, you'll have better insight into some of the unforeseen conditions that come up on adaptive reuse projects and the types of decisions that can impact your project. It's all part of my goal of demystifying the adaptive reuse process for building owners and developers. Today's episode is all about the Packing House in Cambridge, Maryland. From the owner side, I'm joined by Bill Strever, CEO of Cross Street Partners, and Margaret Norfleet Neff, development partner at Cross Street Partners. And from the Quinn Evans design team, I'm joined by Ethan Marchant, a principal who served as a lead architect on the project. They'll share their experiences and insights on this remarkable project. The Packing House was once part of the Cannery Empire, and now it's a hub for innovation and sustainability. If you've been curious about how a building can be programmed to be a catalyst for change, fostering new opportunities and revitalizing the local economy, then this episode is for you. Before we jump into the conversation, let me give you some history on the building. Originally built in 1920 as a furniture factory, the building later became part of the Phillips Packing Company empire, which at its peak employed thousands of people in Cambridge, Maryland, and supplied rations to the troops during World War II. The Phillips Packing Company thrived in the early 20th century and would become the largest producer of canned tomatoes, causing the city of Cambridge on Maryland's eastern shore to earn the nickname as the tomato capital of the world. Production largely took place in Factory F, known as the Packing House, and the building had numerous additions added to it and eventually became a 60,000 square foot building. After the Phillips Packing Company was sold in the mid-1960s, the building was used as an antique store, but eventually fell into disrepair. Oh, and if you're curious, yes, this is the same Phillips brand as the Phillips seafood restaurants that are still located up and down the East Coast. And so, fast forward a bit, and the redevelopment of the Packing House was spearheaded by Cross Street Partners to be a center for local food and beverage production, food business incubation, and nonprofit groups. Quinn Evans led the design efforts and the historic tax credit compliance, because as you'll hear, the project used a variety of funding sources in the equity stack. Be sure to check the show notes for visuals of the project, facility rental information, and other adaptive reuse resources. And while you're in the show notes, go ahead and sign up for the Tangible Remnants newsletter to get adaptive reuse tips right to your inbox. You'll hear more about Quinn Evans later in the episode, but for now, let's jump into the project. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation about the Packing House project in Cambridge, Maryland, featuring Bill Strever, Margaret Norfleet Neff, and Ethan Marchant. I am so excited to be here talking with you all about the Packing House in Cambridge, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore. And so it's a building that has a long history, and I'd love to learn how each of you got involved with the project. So Bill, starting with you, talk a little bit about what attracted you to the building and to the project.
It started with Eastern Shore Conservation Center that we helped the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy do. It's a shared office collaborative of nonprofits around the Eastern Shore and Chesapeake Bay. And the head of the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy said they had this park that they're trying to do in Cambridge, Cannery Park, that was the remnants of what was the largest cannery in the world. And there was this falling down derelict building, one of the last standing of what was a 48 building campus. So that's how we got the introduction, was through ECLF.
What did the building look like when you first got to it?
what kind of state was the building in?
Well, it had swimming pools on the ground floor when you walked in terms of it was in, like all our buildings, in a state of virtual collapse. So it was a challenge.
And then, Margaret, what about you? When did you get to the building and the project?
We got to the building right after we started looking at it, before we purchased it. So it was about 2014. And I was part of the many meetings that we had, you know, standing in boots around the water in moldy spaces, trying to figure out this thing. But it attracted you immediately. The community also attracted us. It's an interesting, vibrant, kind of gritty community. It just said challenge all over it.
Yeah. I remember the first time I toured the building, because I got to work on this project before I joined Quinn Evans. And so I got to work on the National Register nomination for the building. And I remember walking through it and being like, this building is so beautiful. It's definitely a bit of a ruin because it's rust everywhere, all the steel, all the wood, and such a raw state. But it was such a beautiful building, even in that state. And imagining what it could be was really fun. And so I know, Ethan, you were on the design team. And so what phase did you join the project?
I came into the project after the tax credits were awarded as project manager and project architect to assemble and lead the multidisciplinary design team for the vision that was kind of taking shape, right? And like you said, you could just walk into it and feel what it could become. It really had just the potential was just oozing out of the ruins. Needed a lot of vision, but it was easy to come to that vision.
Right. And Bill, I know that your history as a developer and Cross Street's history and all the projects that they do, having the vision of seeing a dilapidated building and thinking it could be something different is something you're very skilled at. Was there something that you saw in the building when you first were deciding to go after it that made you think, yes, we need to do this one?
Well, good question. So certainly one was, what can we do to relate to the rails and trails that was in the works and the Cannery Park? And then related to that, there was a great central atrium space that cried out to be an event space. And I remember one of the first community gatherings we had, which was with a tech innovation gang. We invited a local lady guitar player over and we got a keg of beer and had a pop-up concert and party. And we said, wow, this place is really cool. So that certainly events kind of sang out from the very beginning. And then beyond that, it really was a search for what could fit here. Dorchester County in Cambridge is still recovering from the H.R.A.P. Brown riots and the closing of the cannery in the 60s. And so, you know, trying to figure out what could energize this beautiful falling down building. I think early on, Ken Holt, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, became a great champion for Cambridge generally, but also the Packing House, and said that, you know, we'd like to move our offices there. That was a big help. Early on, we ran into Johnny and Jordan Shockley. I can't remember how and where. Might have been at Blue Ruin having a beer downtown, but they're fourth and fifth generation watermen, and they had an idea for this amazing vertically integrated oyster company that became Blue Oyster Environmental. So those were kind of the key things that started. But Margaret may remember other kind of early interests that helped propel us into this crazy enterprise.
I think you hit on something that was the magical part of that building, is the two-story atrium space. And it is the center. You walk into that space, you've got clear story on both sides. So the magic is there. It pulls together the whole building with a core that can be seen from all sides of the building, as well as these huge doors that go out to the park. So that natural connection to the park and the rails to trails. The park at that point was a very distant idea, and rails to trails came in. That was a thought that they wanted to do. And it took about 10 years to pull the rails to trails together as a combination between local, state, and federal support. We also just spent a lot of time listening in terms of understanding the natural components of the shore, what makes sense there, what needs to live, and what wants to come here that's needed by the community, because Cambridge itself is not a wealthy community. So what does that look like?
And like, I know there's a number of different ways to finance this building, and I can only imagine how the different partnerships had to be explored to figure out how to make the numbers work, how to make the tenants and the uses work. So talk a little bit about how the project was financed and how you were able to find the right partners to work with throughout the project.
We do a ton of adapt to reuse. And the challenge always is there often falling down buildings and distressed neighborhoods that don't have a lot of traditional real estate value driving the economics of financing. So it's typically campaigned to assemble ridiculously complicated capital stack with as little debt as possible, ideally no debt, and maximizing tax credits and grants and other incentives to make the economics viable given the real costs of redeveloping the building and the challenges of finding big credit tenants willing to sign a fat rent long-term lease. It just doesn't happen much. I think there's only like 27 sources of funds. You know, we finished the second phase of the Dayton Arcade and Dayton, $160 million. We have 51 sources of funds there. The core was historic state and federal historic credits. We'd really love to get the state credits a little more robust. It would make it a lot easier. But we got an early award, as Ethan said. It was a new market tax credit census tract, so that helped a ton. So those three things together were probably a little over half. And then the rest was cobbling together a bunch of grants, primarily from the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Is, as I said, under Ken Holt and now under Jake Day, without DHCD, you know, this project would have never happened. And then we have a little bit of debt, which we have a great CDFI, the reinvestment fund, has been a stalwart supporter. So that's our capital stack. And like I said, probably only 30-some million dollars and 20-some sources of funds.
Wow. And I know working with partners and design team that actually understand the implications of how to design the building to make sure that you're in compliance with all the requirements from the different financial sources is super important. So Ethan, talk a little bit about some of the opportunities and challenges that the design team explored as you were trying to make sure to adhere to the requirements of the historic tax credit, while also being mindful of amendments and tenant changes and future proofing the building.
So the initial effort was really focused on the core and shell of the building, which really followed a faithful rehabilitation, a restoration of masonry walls, which were crumbling down, some which needed to be rebuilt, and windows, a deep understanding of how we work with industrial steel sash windows. This project took about 50% of the windows and restored them in place by prepping the existing steel and then reglazing the windows. And the other 50% on the south and west side had been deteriorated just because of the thermal exposure that they had seen over the years where the building was vacant. And those were replaced with historic replica, thermally broken windows. Taking on this sort of faithful restoration approach is really what embeds the project with the character that it has. And so doing the new work for the fit out of the tenant spaces really leaned into this whole notion of respecting that and playing off the old with new very deliberately, not trying to make the new interior architecture look like it's old, but really sort of let that crisp, clean aesthetic kind of bounce off of the historic rustic appearance of the building. The building itself, it had evolved over a series of 10 or 20 years when it was initially built through five different phases of construction, each one of them being different. So even within the single structure, there's different systems, right? There's a heavy wood timber framed original portion of the building that was then immediately augmented with this soaring two-story steel structure, huge windows in that big tooth, really three-story space. And that equally just added to the richness of texture and character of the original artifact. So really getting that central space surrounded by these five different additions was definitely a challenge through detailing and construction. It was an industrial building. The additions were built to solve production needs as the cannery program grew through this building, did not necessarily pay much attention to the impact they would have on the prior phases. So a lot of damage had been done by those additions over time. So that made the project very challenging to get that stuff corrected and kind of fish the new first century infrastructure through a building that was kind of a cobbled together series of additions. So definitely challenges.
Let's take a quick break so you can learn more about the sponsor of this limited series, Quinn Evans. Quinn Evans is a design firm committed to stewardship and the transformation of places that serve and inspire communities. As the proud recipient of the American Institute of Architects 2024 Architecture Firm Award, Quinn Evans is driven by the belief in the power of design to sustain, renew, and reimagine the built environment. Through partnerships with public institutions, nonprofits, and private organizations, Quinn Evans delivers thoughtful design that connects people and leaves a lasting impact. Discover more at quinnevans.com. That's www.quinnevans.com. And now, back to the show.
And so then, Margaret, how was it trying to find tenants for the building that has the different types of character throughout the building, speaking to the various kind of additions and things that Ethan's been talking about?
The talents of the community are wide. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, we found. But jobs are really important, and they're really important to our work. So in meeting people at Shared Use Kitchen was one that, you know, began to show up. And that was an interesting project. It's open and working now, which is great. You know, I think about the work that you did, Nikita, you know, from a sustainability standpoint and looking at those early things. Putting a shared use kitchen in a building like this is tough. It's crazy. Not that it doesn't fit, but if we're looking at LEED and we're looking at sustainability and kind of long-term solutions, air quality too. It was fun, but it was definitely a challenge. And Merge has been wild and wonderful. We've got nonprofits up there and some come and go because they grow and they move on. You know, we've used the word catalyst in terms of describing the Packin House and what it means, because it's not to replace or be the be-all. It's really to create that sense of synergy and energy for the community. So nonprofits, small businesses, people walk in, they love it, and then they figure out how they can be there. That the wide range is really exciting. And again, I think Ethan helped build what this place could really be and how it looked. I do have to go back and tell one story. When we first started working on it and Historic started looking at it, our smokestacks were this big thing because that was the fuel for the Packin House, right? We had to do what, three quarters of a million dollar renovation of those smokestacks before we started funding anything in the building, because they did not want those to go down and they were super important. So you're kind of going, gulp. All right. But that was a fun adventure because it was so much fun to work with structural who came in from all over the country. It was fun to work with the painting people picking it out. They came from Georgia and painted the bricks right outside of the building and then put them back together. Ethan was talking about the type of materials we had to work with. The bricks themselves were super narrow. So when they were going up to take down 30 and 40 feet respectively of these 90-foot smokestacks, they had to harness themselves into the building, which took 4 trips and all this engineering to see how they were going to do it with a less than 8-inch brick connection. It was wild. So that started. And since it was an outdoor piece of the building project, it brought the community forward. You know, they could walk by, they could talk to people, they could start telling stories. It was really nice. We learned a lot. So I just wanted to add that in.
The smokestacks were hanging on by a thread. They didn't just need to be the first piece because it was so iconic. They needed to be restored so they wouldn't fall down as construction was going on. The bricks themselves, we were able to find bricks from the same foundry where the original bricks were made. Mm-hmm. And the painting Margaret was talking about was really to create sort of patina. And as she mentioned, taking down 30 feet off of one of them because it was just not restorable. Once it was rebuilt, you can hardly notice where that change from old to new happens because of that in the field patination that was done by specialty painters.
I would add on the smokestacks that my recollection is there was a turkey vulture nest in there, and the masons were up there delicately trying to dissemble the smokestack with the turkey vultures flying around their head. And our is you come over the Choptank River on 50 into Cambridge, you can see the stacks. So one of these days, we'd love to be able to do the lighting and art project. Is that would be the landmark to guide you to the Packin House. Just one thing on the uses that we're excited about right now, building on the Blue Oyster Environmental, John H. Jordan Chalkley, and the rich history of the oyster industry in Dorchester County and its importance, not only from an economic job and business point of view, but also in terms of cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, since oysters eat nitrogen and phosphorus, which is one of the main pollutants of the bay. So that building on that, Jake Day has rallied a collaboration that we're really thrilled about, which we're calling the Packing House Chesapeake Bay Oyster Hub, which has key collaborators, Blue Oyster Environmental, the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences, UMSIS that Margaret described, and their Horn Point Laboratory, which is really focused on oyster and ecology resource just down the road from the Packing House, and the National Aquarium and University of Maryland Baltimore, which has kind of roots in the Eastern Shore. And those have all come together around this multi-dimensional, multi-component hub, which starts with Blue Oyster and their really state-of-the-art equipment to ramp up oyster processing. Their goal is to increase oyster production fivefold the Chesapeake Bay in coming years with their hatchery and aquaculture business. And then they've added on that a environmental shoreline restoration business that does artificial reefs with oysters, again, that eat the bad stuff in the bay, and you do nutrient credit trading. So Blue Oyster was the start. And then, as Margaret described, as part of the National Park Service Chesapeake Bay Gateway, we'll have this really wonderful educational exhibit using the fantastic expertise of the aquarium at doing these kind of interactive exhibits. Events will be a very important component. We want every oyster event on the bay to be at the Packing House. And the fourth thing is building on the merged shared office, and we're adding a shared lab facility to it. Shared office and labs have really become an important synergy. So entrepreneurs growing out of the research at UMSIS down the road, University of Maryland Baltimore has offered up their platform for supporting commercialization of research at the Packing House. So we're really excited to have this oyster hub of oyster processing and oyster education and oyster events and oyster research and business launching, entrepreneurial support, all coming together. And then we're going to have a place to eat oysters.
I love it. And I love also that it ties in very well to the history of the building, since food has always been a staple of the building.
Another piece that we play with a lot is music. And music is really big, and it's so important to Cambridge. So we're working on how we create kind of a resource there, whether it's a recording studio, whether it's, you know, whatever that is, because there's so much in the community that doesn't get out, and so many, and for kids learning or anybody who wants to learn. So that's another piece that we kind of think fits also with the culinary components. We didn't do as much green work as we wanted to do, or that we could do. And, you know, I think a lot of that is just your relationship with the city officials and just, and the systems and what the systems can bear. One of the great green things that we did was the parking lot. For a community that literally is about a half an inch from floodplains everywhere, when they have these torrential rains, which we're experiencing, it is really exciting to watch these bioswales fill up, never run over, and then just go down like it was part of a beautiful symphony piece. And it really is a very important component to the Packing House and having those bioswales feed into the park and everything else. So it's one of our favorite pieces in terms of banging our heads around stormwater and funky things like that, that we get excited about. So that was, since the Packing House actually held all the water for the street. So once we lifted it up, all the water went back out on the street.
Yeah, and that's great. And I think one of the things to note about this project that I think was really fantastic, that is it got historic tax credits. It also was LEED certified gold. And so it really was blending the historic and sustainable and trying to show how do we actually put community uses back into this vacant building and make it the best of both worlds so that we can show really what it could be. So I think that was a big success of the project, to be able to navigate through all of the approvals and the processes and make sure that there is this connection between the community and the building, dealing with stormwater, dealing with all of those pieces. I think that was a really big success of the project.
It was. And without strong LEED leadership that you all provided and that we were lucky to have throughout the whole project, we actually had to take away our air quality LEED points because we decided to go with a system that was much more adaptable to the future. And this was right around the COVID time. So we let go of those, but we're able to, again, build other credits with the help of strong LEED leadership that really added other great components to the buildings. Again, it takes everybody, which is half of the fun.
Yeah. And it sounds like there's been a lot of community interaction with the building since it's been opened. How has the building been received since the renovation?
People really love it. They do. And they feel welcomed in it. And that's what we wanted. So yeah, they love it and they marvel at it. Some people don't get it. The more people bring like different organizations to have a meeting, say in the atrium, it's kind of wild to fill them in. And then all of a sudden they start percolating. And then the bird space is wonderful because you feel like you're in a treehouse looking out, right? And the community space is so elegant, yet totally welcoming. People can hang out. Different groups can talk. It's terrific.
It's fantastic. Well, I know this project had a lot of moving pieces and parts on it, but if there are any lessons learned from this project that you would want to share with someone who might be considering a similar undertaking of a building that was also vacant for many years and wants to be turned into something new, any lessons learned or tips for someone who might be considering something similar?
Two things. You know, one is finding the kind of uses like Margaret described that really sing with the building, that resonate with its kind of inherent character to drive the planning and programming and ultimately the economics. And then with that, the need for as little debt as possible, ideally no debt. So you really have the best trajectory for long-term success and sustainability of the tenants, of the programs, of the services in the building. So you can have the lowest possible occupancy costs with amazing reuse of these old spaces. So that would be my pitch, is try to cobble together, as ridiculously complicated as it is, and let's get the state to up its state historic credits and these other kinds of subsidies, because I think only with that kind of support are these projects really viable. So that'd be my pitch. You know, great users, inspiring partners that really sing to where the building is, the community, and what the building is, but then go through the headaches of assembling a capital stack that gives you a real chance at success long term.
I would totally agree. However, I'm going to just spread it out just a little bit, because if we don't take the risk, we have a monotone development core and we lose these buildings. So they're finding that extra little support, I think, that Bill's talking about. But if you wait until you have it figured out, it will never happen. And then such a key thing is, why would a team that might not be from an area go into an area? What is it? Why? What brought them there? And that catalyzes and brings together people's ideas of like, wait a second, we're worth it. We're worth it. So wait, let's look at ourselves. So there is that risk. I think the deeper partnerships going into these projects, as well as funding, you know, is huge help. But sometimes the call is just too strong and you take it on.
And one of the things that Margaret mentioned earlier, I think is really important and helps justify the hard work to resurrect these old buildings and the kind of incentives and subsidies that are essential, which is, we've done over 15 million square feet of adaptive reuse old buildings. Everyone that's been put back in commercial use today that's completed has more jobs today than in their original industrial heyday. Procter & Gamble was 750 people in the 70s when they were making ivory soap on the Baltimore Harbor, and 3,000 when Under Armour had their world headquarters there. And example after example of that. So these buildings can resonate in today's market, these old buildings, and can be real transformative catalysts to the local economy in creating business, job, programs, services that really are important and drive the revitalization of neighborhoods that really need help. So I think that's one of the big winners. We're not at that job count yet at Packing House, but my bet is in the end. Now, there are 48 buildings, so we're not going to have the same number of jobs that the cannery had in 48 buildings. But I wouldn't be surprised that when we're done, we'll have more jobs than when the cannery was cranking away canning beans and corn.
Yeah. Ethan, what about you? Any lessons learned or tips?
In these types of projects, on the technical side of things, to look for these opportunities where a solution to a specific problem can address multiple different issues. Where a roof is caving in already, can you restructure that in a way that can support mechanical equipment, reinforce other aspects of the building? I think understanding immediately what the building may be able to become, right? Where windows might not be transparent. To really lean into that vision where windows are like, imagine if, this was just flooded with light. And, you know, the day the windows come in is really when that takes shape. To really push that vision up front, it can really change a lot. Most of these old buildings relied on natural light. That's probably the single biggest feature. That single piece alone really is the piece that can get you past that daunting task of looking at a building that's crumbling and has trees growing out of the roof and covered in vines and such.
Amazing.
I think we should say that Merge is this delightful environment. You can come with your laptop and work. You can have a little private office, short-term, very flexible, very affordable. All the business amenities you get, the great kitchen, social gathering space, ton of meeting rooms. And now we're going to have a lab space next to it. So if you're a nonprofit or starting a business and want a place to hang out, and where there's going to be, I'm sure, a place to have oysters downstairs, that come to the Packing House.
I love it. We'll put a link to all of the various organizations in the Packing House and also to Merge as well, so people can learn more about it, figure out how to sign up and get there. It's amazing.
That's a wrap on the Building Reuse is Climate Action Limited series sponsored by Quinn Evans. Be sure to check the show notes from all of the episodes to learn more about the guests and to download various adaptive reuse resources. I hope you have enjoyed this journey as much as I have, and that you now have better insights into what to expect when working on your next adaptive reuse project. Until next time.